Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and Will Campion and I have created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. We hope through direct and insightful interviews with masters of the real-life money maze, we're going to learn about different approaches to allocating capital, making investment and business decisions, and navigating the pitfalls that line the paths to prosperity. Whether you're a current or aspiring investor, entrepreneur, professional, or a student exploring career options, we hope you gain some helpful insights and enjoy the shows. You can keep up to date by visiting moneymazepodcast.com, and please sign up to our newsletter to ensure you won't miss a release. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe, and we'd love you to tell a friend or colleague about it. Thank you for listening. Today in this Money Maze podcast special edition, we're going to discuss the radical shift underway in the world of strategic metals, essential for the energy transition. A shift that has been dubbed as creating once-in-a-century investment opportunities. As listeners to the Money Maze podcast know, I'm a gnarly old value investor, not prone to investment hype, but have been following these developments for the last few years and am fascinated by my guest's observation that this process is reshaping whole industries. Altering the geopolitical landscape, and the key to success will be the ability to secure the supply of the technology metals. And my job today is to help set out why this is a seismic shift and why TechMet and its founder and CEO Brian Mennell is at the epicenter of this revolution. So the plan is to discuss this transforming landscape, the huge supply-demand imbalance, the geopolitical challenges and realities, and the potential returns from being invested and how my guest business is organized. So without further ado, Brian Mennell from TechMet, welcome to the Money Maze podcast.
Thank you very much, Simon.
Now, I know you're widely quoted in the FT and Bloomberg and industry events on this topic, but looking back and doing a little research ahead of our conversation today, I actually realized that it was your grandfather who had founded the Anglo-Vaal Group. So you really grew up as part of a mining dynasty.
My family has been in mining in Southern Africa since my grandfather founded the Anglo-Vaal Group in the early 1930s. And certainly since that time, and in fact for many generations before that, there has not been the type of demand-supply dislocation that we're at the beginning of for a subset of mined natural resources.
So I guess the question that sprung to my mind, first of all, was that growing up in that environment, was there any other career consideration other than mining?
I was always interested in mining and metals, and that's what I have spent my life and career doing. So I never really considered other areas, but within the context of natural resources and primary resource development, I have been through a number of iterations. I did work for De Beers for a number of years after having left university in the US, and back in Anglo-Vaal, we did develop a wide range of base metals, precious metals, and ferrous metal resources and fairly diverse industrial interests.
So before we set the stage for TechMet, the company that you founded and CEO of, I think it'd be really helpful to set the stage to understand the global revolution that is underway. I think you have been quoted as saying that the West has lost a war they didn't know they were fighting. So just summarize the state of play.
I think we all recognize and accept that the energy transition is unstoppable and is accelerating, and that important elements of that energy transition and climate change mitigation are the rapid growth of demand and capacity of the industry to supply electric vehicles to replace diesel and petrol engine vehicles, and obviously the growing portion of the global power generation grids accounted for by renewable energy technologies and the battery storage associated with facilitating the next phase of renewable energy. What is not yet adequately appreciated, though the world is starting to appreciate it better and better every month, is the extent to which these technologies driving the energy transition are dependent on a relatively small number of specialty metals. And that these metals, lithium, cobalt, nickel, rare earth metals, and a few others, are in structural short supply, the scalability of their supply to meet this exponential growth in demand is very inefficient, and the supply pipeline of these key critical minerals is controlled by China, who has spent the last 15 years executing an enormously successful program across all the primary resource and processing capacity for these inputs into these energy mobility technologies, which are going to be amongst the key drivers of industrial and technological competitiveness and success of major economies across the world over the next 5, 10, 20, and 50 years. And the Chinese clearly saw this 20 years ago and have acted on it, while the West and Japan and others have been sleeping. And that has enormous geopolitical consequences and very considerable national security consequences for the US and others.
So we're going to dive into the demand and supply components of that in a minute, but just help me, as a Luddite, why are these metals to which you've referred so key in this transition?
Batteries are quite metal intensive. Lithium-ion batteries, which are the power source of choice for electric vehicles and will be for many years to come, are composed of a cathode and an anode. The cathode is generally nickel and cobalt and manganese. The anode is, in most instances, now graphite, though there are many programs to develop other anode technologies. And both the anode and cathode and the electrolyte through which the charge flows in the battery is lithium. So these are the key components of batteries. On-grid and off-grid storage to facilitate the next phase of renewable energy likewise requires battery systems which are heavy and metal intensive. They're not necessarily just lithium-ion batteries, they're vanadium redox flow batteries and others. But again, these are drivers of demand of these specialty metals way, way beyond historical production or demand from other applications.
So when we think about the big consumers of these, it will be, of course, the global car manufacturers. How worried are they?
They're worried, and that worry is beginning to turn into panic. They are putting an enormous amount of work into understanding the supply chain feeding into their EV programs, and they're coming a long way, and they're starting to realize that in order to ensure preferential access to supply of these battery metals, they're going to have to engage in the supply pipeline and take equity risk at the production end in a manner that they did not anticipate they would have to do even a year or two ago. So they're getting there, but I don't think they've yet fully appreciated, and nor have providers of capital or the markets or government agencies, the cliff that we're heading towards. There's now, I think, in excess of $500 billion of committed capex by the global automakers going into the electrification of their fleets over the next 10 years. In fact, the capital commitments are over the next 2-3 years. So tens and tens of billions of dollars to build new lithium-ion battery manufacturing facilities with partners and to build capacity to produce electric vehicles. There's an almost inescapable inevitability that in 5 years' time, half of this massively increased capacity will be sitting idle because the VWs, the GMs, the Fords, and others are simply not going to be able to secure adequate supplies of the inputs into this manufacturing ecosystem. And the winners will be those that are owned by China, who has a 15-year head start in managing the supply chain, or those few companies that act decisively and imaginatively today to engage in the supply chain for these critical metals in a way that gives them an advantage. So there are going to be some big shocks to the auto industry as it electrifies, and that has big implications. A country like Germany, I believe somewhere close to 20% of the economy is in some way linked to the vehicle manufacturing ecosystem. And that transformation of that industry to electric vehicles is going to be very traumatic, even if it were to be successful. If half of the capacity that's being built is idle in terms of national economies, global economies, employment, it's potentially extremely damaging.
So this is leading us in due course to your company's expertise and advantage and head start. But just before we move to that, when we talk about the supply problems, again, help listeners and potential investors understand why it is so difficult to identify, mine, bring to market these key metals?
A number of these key metals are constrained in terms of existence of discovered primary resources. Tin, which is a key element that people have not adequately appreciated because an electric vehicle has 7 times the tin of a diesel or petrol engine vehicle, and tin is the primary solder on all electronic circuit boards. Nickel, or at least the right nickel for batteries, vanadium for redox flow batteries, rare earth metals for permanent magnets in electric engines, all of which are constrained geologically. And therefore, discovering and developing new resources as prices go up, which they must in order to stimulate supply to meet the growth in demand, is a lengthy and difficult business. But even in the case of lithium, there's a lot of lithium in the world. There's massive brine-based lithium resources in Chile and Argentina. There's big hard rock lithium deposits in Australia and Africa and elsewhere. But the pace at which these resources can be developed in order to meet demand is very lengthy, capital intensive, energy intensive, technology intensive, environmentally problematic, and slow. So a new lithium deposit to develop on scale to make a meaningful contribution to the supplying into the battery industry can take 5 to 10 years. So even where you've got considerable global resource, like in lithium, supply is going to lag demand for the next 2, 5, 10, and 15 years, regardless of prices doubling again, which they will have to in order to, in part over time, solve this problem. I mean, look at Tesla's plan is to produce 20 million electric vehicles by 2030. If they achieve that ambition, that alone will require 3 times the present total global annual supply of lithium. That's just Tesla. Forget about VW, Ford, GM, and the Chinese, who presently produce 60% of the world's batteries and electric vehicles and are also growing in that space quicker than their Western competitors. So this is not achievable. And what does that mean? It means prices have to go up. So people like us as TechMeta are in a fantastic position in the zone of supply-demand dislocation in terms of value creation because we're building capacity to produce and process and recycle these critical minerals. It will result in the reduction in cost of battery systems, at least slowing, if not reversing, which will have implications for growth and demand because prices won't continue to come down to the extent they have been doing so over the last 10 years. And that has massive implications for the auto industry, for the energy transition, and for climate change mitigation globally as a whole. This is a crisis that needs to be addressed. It needed to be addressed yesterday. You know, our industry needed to deploy $100 billion 3 years ago to avoid the crisis we're now heading towards, and that is close to unavoidable. But it's not too late to reduce the extent of that structural shortage that has these implications that I've outlined.
So that brings us squarely to TechMet. You found it in 2017. And just tell me, why was the company born?
In 2017, I was involved in a range of natural resource projects around Southern Africa and elsewhere in the world through private vehicles that were fairly diverse. They included some projects that are now part of TechMet in our technology metal space, but I was engaged in a number of other businesses. In 2017, to me, it became so obvious that we were at a unique moment in history at the beginning of a supply-demand dislocation for a number of mined products that had never been seen since the impact of the Industrial Revolution on demand for coal and iron ore in the late 18th, early 19th centuries. And therefore, given my network, my background, my expertise, my teams, industry relationships and deal flow, there was no question in my mind that everything else I was doing was so much less compelling and exciting, both in terms of value creation opportunity and in terms of trying to contribute constructively to a clean, sustainable world and to good governance and the transformation of our industry to be ESG compliant and responsible in terms of its contribution to the energy transition, that I had no hesitation in selling, spinning off or withdrawing from direct engagement in everything else I was doing in order to create TechMet, which I did, is now my sole focus of attention, and grow it into the platform and portfolio of projects that we're investing in and growing and building today.
So 5 years on, I understand that you acquire and manage projects that produce and process and recycle these key strategic technology metals. But let's get into the weeds here, or under the crust. Tell me, how is the fund and the business being constructed?
It's a very simple structure. It's not a fund. So we have a limitless time frame. We're a private company domiciled in Ireland. So we're a permanent capital vehicle. We have one class of ordinary shares. So we simply raise equity and on deploy equity into private projects and private companies that produce or process or recycle our target metals and metal chemicals. And in so doing, build dominant minority positions, or in certain instances, controlling positions, but in all cases with board seats, governance rights, and mechanisms to engage and add value daily, weekly, and monthly in all the projects that we are the primary funder of. We have producing projects that we're expanding, and we have a number of substantial development projects in Africa, North America, South America, and now in Europe through our investment in Cornish Lithium to develop lithium chemicals production from both hard rock and brine-based lithium resources in Cornwall to be the cornerstone of a localized UK supply chain feeding into a lithium-ion battery manufacturing industry in UK, which has to develop if the UK is going to have an auto industry in the next 5 years.
So when you think about these various activities, just help us understand how they are split up between the sourcing, the collaboration, and the actual metals themselves.
From inception, we have sought to deploy capital and hence build value equally distributed across the middle portion of the value pipeline for these metals. So in approximately a third mining, a third processing, and a third recycling. We don't do exploration and long lead times to positive cash flow projects, albeit they're in many instances interesting and important. There are a lot of discovered resources that can be developed, and we don't feel that as TechMet we need to find new resources. So we're engaged from late stage feasibility study through to production, processing, and recycling, and to an extent through a new investment we've just made in a company called Zerion in Dayton, Ohio, battery manufacturing technologies. And Zerion is producing uniquely high performance, low cost, and low carbon footprint cathodes and batteries in a process that is quite unique in battery manufacturing history, as a direct electroplating of cathodes in a molten salt bath, which means you can use much lower grade inputs than you would normally have to use in cathode manufacturing, which for us as producers of nickel hydroxide product out of Brazil, lithium chlorides, cobalt, and other products, is potentially transformative, which justifies our involvement in battery technologies, which is not our focus. It's on the fringes of our mandate and our expertise.
So when you sit in front of capital allocators, how do you condense the investment proposition and think about the timelines for returns?
We are, as I mentioned, a permanent capital vehicle. So we invest in private projects and private companies with an open-ended time frame. So we don't have to exit as one would if one was a fixed-term fund, and that's why we chose not to be a fund. However, our strategy is to have a rolling private equity-type strategy in a private permanent capital vehicle that does build value at the asset level, and over a period of 2 to 5 years, and it varies considerably depending on the asset and the markets, and we'll continue to remain flexible and opportunistic in terms of how we build, crystallize, and extract value. But we do seek to build projects and companies that we can list or sell in order to, in part, distribute value to shareholders as dividends, and in part, redeploy in continuing to expand our other projects and add to our portfolio. So that will continue to be the case. So we do anticipate growing the platform because we have a great portfolio, great team, and we're a unique moment in history for our industry, but distribute value along the way to our shareholders. So we do create liquidity, and we hope to commence with that this year.
So let's just talk about that team and your advisory board, which I've observed has got some very interesting figures and individuals on them. How have you selected them and how have you built out the team around you?
All the team who came on board early on in the development of TechMet were people I'd known and worked with over many years in the mining and metals industry or in financial services, supporting our industry from a funding, structuring and M&A point of view. So we've got a very strong core group here in London and a strong group on the financial management, reporting, control, regulatory, secretarial side in Ireland, where we're domiciled. From a board and advisory board point of view, again, they've all been involved from pretty early on, or most of them has. Our advisory board is chaired by Admiral Mike Mullen, who is chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff of the United States under and principal military advisor both to Bush Jr. and Obama, and has since been director of General Motors, director of Sprint, director of Bloomberg Foundation, etc. So he's been enormously supportive and engaged and valuable to us, not only in terms of Washington network and ecosystem, but in terms of global geopolitical insights and relationships and standing. We have people on our advisory board like Professor Vasant Kumar, head of material chemistry at Cambridge and one of the foremost battery chemistry researchers in the world. Jonathan Leslie, former executive director of Rio Tinto, and a number of others. So we've put together a very, very strong group from a governance point of view, from an execution point of view, from a global industry and geopolitical strategic point of view. So I think we have a uniquely scalable platform into which we can deploy not only hundreds of millions of dollars, which we're doing, but potentially billions of dollars over the next 5-10 years to create bigger and bigger projects that make a more and more meaningful contribution to these inputs into the energy transition in a way that's ESG compliant, ethical, low carbon footprint, which again is a way in which we and our industry needs to differentiate itself from Chinese players and transform itself in order to be a sustainable contributor to a clean, renewable energy, sustainable future for the world.
So let's stay with that ESG, because I think most of us would agree there are some contradictions and challenges. People want the end product, which is EVs whizzing around with lower carbon footprints, but we've got to have mines and we've got to have extraction and we have to have all of the attendant issues. And that word sustainability is, I would argue, overused. How do you define it and why would you contend that your business is the good citizen?
Mining has a generally negative perceptions associated with it in the eyes of the impact investing ESG world. The assumption is that mining is fundamentally negative from an environmental impact point of view and from a social and political engagement point of view. And that is understandable given some of the industry's history, but it does not have to be the case. Mining can be very environmentally and ecologically responsible, and it can be low carbon footprint. And it has to be. And increasingly, the market for our products, being the Teslas and VWs of this world, are and will increasingly demand it in a manner that's traceable and independently audited and verified. And that's a challenge we have to rise to as an industry, and a challenge that TechMet seeks to be at the forefront of across all of our projects and investment, be they production, processing, or recycling. And we do. It costs a little bit more. It takes a lot of time and effort to operate and develop in a responsible manner in environments that in some cases are challenging. But that's what we do. And that's what we have to do. And that's what the whole industry has to do better and better every month and every year.
So those of us who are invested in the mining companies, the listed mining companies over the years, have known that the three challenges have been execution, number one, trust in management, number two, and with that, I suppose, is dilution that has happened at the equity level a lot. So maybe just, I know you are not principally involved in the extraction, but tell me a little bit about how you think about those challenges.
Well, we're investing exclusively in partnership with management teams who we have known for many, many years and who we have a high degree of trust in their ethical standards and in their competence and ability to execute and deliver technically. And we oversee technical operational project development daily and weekly with our core team who has a lot of experience of the industry and of all of these metals, geographies, technologies. And we obviously engage from an ESG point of view and a global political risk management and counterparty network development point of view. So we work very closely with very good people who have initiated and built these projects that we have the dominant funder of and building dominant positions in. But there is, we're in an industry where there is development risk and challenges, but they're ones that we've spent our working lives dealing with, and we believe in all cases we can continue to deal with effectively. We're not building iron ore mines with 500 kilometer railways. These are $50 to $500 million projects that are producing low volume, high value products. So they're fairly much less capital intensive and much more confined timeframes to positive cash flows than a lot of the traditional mining industry.
Let's talk about your investors' current and prospective. You've been able to attract some very well-respected investors. So maybe you could just start by telling up to this point who have been your investors and the size of the assets today. And then let's talk about what your expectation and hope is as you grow this business.
We have, from inception, in addition to the funding and assets that I contributed, and I remain a major shareholder of TechMet, we sought to appeal to a high net worth and family office universe. And that's what we did. And the equity, the source of the equity we bought in to fund the establishment of our core portfolio over the first 3 years of TechMet's history. So we now have 65 family office investors who are a great group of blue chip high net worth families across North America, Europe, a couple in Japan, one in India, a couple out of South Africa. So it's a very nice global network that's added value to us beyond the equity that's been contributed, that's obviously funded our growth and the development of our project. In late 2020, we received direct equity investment from the United States International Development Finance Corporation as a U.S. government funding agency, and they remain a major shareholder. And that was a very credentializing and de-risking event. It was the first time in history that a U.S. government agency had taken a direct equity interest in a metals and mining company, and remains the only time in history. So we are unique in as far as being the only metals and mining company in the world ever with direct U.S. government equity. And that has opened up, obviously, a lot of sources of potential investment. We've raised the last money, I guess, about 8 months ago. We're now preparing for a further round of funding. We're raising another $200 million with a view to focusing much more on bigger checks from an institutional audience. And I think the world has somewhat caught up with our strategy. We no longer have to sell the macro tailwind idea, and therefore we are, I believe, likely to be able to secure all that financing relatively quickly from a few larger sources. We do have non-family office shareholders. We have Lansdowne Partners in London, who are a substantial UK institution who've been a very supportive and substantial investor and shareholder. We have Mercuria in Geneva, who are one of the biggest global energy and commodity trading groups, with sales last year, I think, certainly in excess of $100 billion. And with Mercuria, we have created TechMet Mercuria as a 50-50 owned vehicle to trade, market, and perform supply chain management services for all of our metals and metal chemicals going into the OEMs and other end users, both for our own projects as they increase the flow of products, and for third parties to build a strong trading capacity, not only as a source of revenue and profits for TechMet, which it will be very material, but as an added source of intelligence and data to feed our equity investment program, which obviously remains the focus of our strategy at the TechMet level.
So the value of the company pre the next financing is how much?
We have a present conservative fair value of around $550 million, or we did last year when we last had an independent view of our value. The value at which we raise money in the next round, which we hope to formalize in the next month and a half, remains to be defined. but it'll obviously be somewhere north of that as a pre-money valuation.
And if you were describing the preferred clients that you would have in this round, just tell me, what do they look like?
We would like to graduate from our universe of high net worth and family office investors to large permanent capital institutions. So big pension funds, endowments, sovereign wealth structures are our desired audience. Institutions who want to and can write $50, $100, $200 million checks and can follow their interest as we continue to scale the platform and grow, which we intend to do over the next coming years and decades. This is a 20-year supply-demand dislocation, not a two-year market inefficiency. We've got a long way to go, and we're in the right place at the right time to continue to create an enormous amount of value for our shareholders and hopefully an enormous amount of value for the world in terms of helping to transform our industry and balance the Western supply chains away from reliance on China in this crucial area.
I sense you got a head start, but just tell me a little bit about the competitive landscape, what the big mining companies are doing, and actually what can they do that is material to their business. Just tell me about that competitive landscape.
Because the world's caught up with our strategy in terms of understanding and appetite for the critical minerals and energy transition space, it's much easier for us to raise money. So we're much less capital constrained. It's a matter of value and who we go to get the right money with the right network and the right value and vision. However, obviously the deployment of capital into projects at value levels where we can continue to add the shareholder value that we have achieved over the last 4 years, which is very, very considerable value creation, is going to become more and more difficult as our space becomes more crowded and more competitive, and there are more entrants looking for exposure to these critical minerals, which there are. I mean, off a relatively low base, remarkably, and our industry remains very immature and dependent on generally badly managed and badly financed junior companies on volatile, illiquid exchanges. But nonetheless, the big miners who have been largely absent from our metals are waking up to the fact that they're going to miss out on the biggest mining boom of our generation and our fathers and grandfathers and great-grandfathers' generation. So the Rios and Anglos and BHPs are seeing how they can increase their exposure to nickel and how they can get into lithium. However, you can't deploy $1 billion in rare earth metals or tin or vanadium or tungsten. The projects in the markets just aren't big enough, and therefore they don't move the dial for the big global mining listed international mining companies. And even where you can build critical mass that's relevant to a BHP, like in lithium and nickel, they're big, bureaucratic, slow companies by their nature that will find it very difficult to wean themselves off generating massive earnings, mining iron ore in the Pilbara and paying multi-billion dollar dividends. And therefore, they are going to continue to fail our industry and the world with respect to playing the role they should play in the scaling of the global supply of these critical energy transition metals. They're not going to lead. They should lead. BHP or Rio shouldn't be paying a $20 billion dividend. They should be spending $20 billion or half of that building lithium mines, and they're dabbling and they're sort of half thinking about doing it, but they're really not doing it to the extent that they should for their shareholders, or they should to make a constructive contribution to the world.
You mentioned Lansdowne as one of your investors. I was talking to Pete Davis of Lansdowne, and he raised the question really for you, which is, given one cannot allow China to control this market without a response, do Western democracies need to use companies like yours more proactively, and how should they do it?
That's a very, very good question. And we do spend quite a lot of time in Washington and to an extent in Tokyo, where we also have a senior advisor to the Japanese prime minister on our board and are working with government agencies and big industrial players in Japan. But in Washington, where we've done the most work, we are, apart from having US government shareholding through DFC, we are engaged with the Department of Energy and the Department of Defense and the State Department and National Security Council on the space. And it's a higher and higher priority every day. And they do recognize the geopolitical, national security, and industrial competitiveness implications of ongoing failure vis-a-vis China in these supply chains. What they should do about it is not easy. I mean, we are the beneficiary of equity investment, but we need 500 tech METs yesterday. So we do need the Department of Energy loan program to become functional. We do need the State Department, Department of Energy to engage. And they are starting to, but they need to do so at a totally different level. And we're trying to catalyze that and help with that.
Great. I've got a few closing questions. Russia's moved on Ukraine. How does that affect your landscape?
It's unsettling and destabilizing for markets in general. And that's not good. It certainly refocuses attention on vulnerability of Western industry to supply chains controlled by China and to a lesser extent Russia, and by the access that will doubtlessly be strengthened between China and Russia. Everybody knows about Russia's importance to the gas and energy equation in Europe, but it's less appreciated that Russia also produces 17% of the world's grade one nickel, which is the nickel suitable for lithium-ion battery manufacturing. It's nothing like as powerful and important as China in the context of our industry, but it's not insignificant. So any disruption will add to the focus on these vulnerabilities, which is good for us geopolitically. It's not good for us in terms of market instability because it's not good for anybody, but it certainly makes one think about where one's inputs come from and how to secure reliable supply if you're a VW or a General Motors.
Brian, I'm going to ask you three final questions, and they're general questions. This one you can answer in relation to your business or not, but who would you most like to meet and explain your investment case to?
That's a very good question. I mean, our audience, or the audience that we want to help to mobilize in order to succeed as an industry and as a company on a bigger and bigger scale, are two audiences. One is government, and we are engaged. At a presidential level in the US is not necessarily the right level to stimulate action, but senior politicians in the US, Japan are a very important audience for us, and they have to engage. They're not the solution. Private sector is the solution, but regulations and government funding support, given China's enormous support for their interests as a state, financially and otherwise, is very important. The other audience that I'd love to appeal to is big institutions. There's this massive pool of ESG, climate change, impact investing capital that's growing every day. And up till now, it's largely ignored our industry because the assumption is that even though they know that metals go into batteries and renewable energy systems, they don't really want to get their head around the reputational PR perceived ESG risk of metals and mining, and they have to. So I would like to sit with the Larry Finks of this world and say, look, we need tens of billions of dollars as an industry, and we can be part of that as TechMet. And we're going to do it in an ESG-compliant, responsible way, and we're going to be a responsible contributor to the energy transition, which everybody wants. But we need a lot of money to do it. We need efficient cost of capital to counter Chinese extremely efficient cost of capital for their companies and their developments and their supply pipeline. And we need it in order to scale supply to meet the demands that we all want not to see retarded. So the big institutions in this world are really the audience that I'd love to sit down with and convince. It's lovely having COP26, and it's lovely having all these big institutions stand on stage and say we're against climate change and we want to mitigate greenhouse gas emissions. But for COP26 to have not had critical minerals and the mining and metal processing industry on the agenda or in attendance is ridiculous. And that has to be changed.
Now, we had BlackRock on the Money Maze podcast, so we will make sure that they at least are aware of your podcast here. And there's some very interesting research being done just this week that I read by Chris Woods, which has said that given the underperformance of late of a number of these ESG funds, the beginning of scrutiny of those companies that are greening or are part of this revolution than rather simply are green, which I think is encouraging because I have waded in on this as well. Those two last questions. You're a man of great discipline, I know, because you fast periodically. Why?
It's not directly pertinent to technology metals, but I think there are benefits in periodically starving oneself in order to stimulate mechanisms in your body that are healthy. It's probably also good discipline. I think generally in the Western world, we eat too much and we're too soft and self-indulgent. So it's good to force oneself to be disciplined.
And my final question before I sum up is, I understand that Nelson Mandela read the address at your father's funeral. Just explain to everybody how that came about.
After his release from prison, he became a friend of my father's and spent a lot of time with us during both pre his presidency and while he was president and after he retired from the presidency. So he used to come and spend a number of holidays with us on our family farm in Cape Town. So I was enormously privileged to have an opportunity to spend many, many hours with him, which was a wonderful experience, given his not only mythical standing as a figure of our age, certainly in the South African context, but as a quite remarkable human being. So he was a friend of my father's, and they co-founded the Mandela Children's Fund together, which my father was the deputy chairman of under Mandela's chairmanship. So he felt a bond with my father, which was surprising. I mean, my father came from a rich, privileged business background, and obviously Mandela came out of 27 years in prison, but for some reason they liked each other very much.
Great. Well, look, Brian, this has been a really insightful conversation. I'm going to take away three conclusions. Number one, the extraordinary shift that is taking place courtesy of the energy transition. Number two, the huge opportunities but very high barriers to entry and execution. And number three, your fund has established a track record already, and allocators A should be looking at this space and probably should be talking to you as well.
Yeah, I mean, the problem with us is the opportunities to invest in us are limited. We don't want too many shareholders. So I would encourage people to not only look at us, if they're big institutions who want to write $50, $100 million checks, which is what we're now seeking, but would look at the few and problematic, but nonetheless growing other opportunities to deploy capital in the space through other companies developing lithium projects and nickel projects and rare earth projects. And I know that it's not normal to promote and advertise other focuses of investment other than ourselves, but we do want to play a role in the development of our industry, not just the development of TechMet and creating value for TechMet shareholders, which we will continue to do, but we need the industry as a whole to succeed and be fundable for the sake of the world. We have projects around Rwanda and the tin and tungsten mines, nickel cobalt development in Brazil, lithium in Europe and the United States, recycling in North America and elsewhere in the world for lithium ion batteries, very, very important part of this equation and our industry, which we've pioneered. So we'll continue to grow that network. We're the lowest cost producer in the world in our U.S. vanadium business in Arkansas of the electrolyte of vanadium redox flow batteries. So there's a lot we're doing and there's a lot we're going to continue to do and build. But we do need to be part of an ecosystem from a financing point of view, from an industry transformation point of view, that results in us not retarding or negatively impacting in all ways on the energy transition.
Brian, thank you for your clarity. Thank you for your time. Look forward to having further conversations.
Thank you, Simon.
All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.